This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Do it. Susan Tyler Hitchcock joins me live in studio, local author and historian, the author of numerous books. Her website is susantylerhitchcock.com. It's good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
I can't believe I was just thinking as I was coming over here today that you've never been on this program before. And I was thinking,
I've been in the studio before, but it was before this program existed.
It's been a while.
Well,
my apologies. My apologies. Well, hopefully, you know, don't be a stranger.
Yes, indeed.
There's so much that we want to talk about. And what we really want to look at today while you're here is one of the books that you have written, which is Frankenstein, A Cultural History. And before we talk about it, let's refresh our memories and go back to 1931.
Oh, it's alive! It's alive! It's alive! It's alive! Oh,
Mason, come on.
When this dead hand moves, the monster created by a man they called Mad is turned loose to strike terror into the hearts of men. To shock women into uncontrolled hysteria.
Elizabeth!
To prey upon the innocence of children. This is the story you've heard about, talked about. The spine-tingling, blood-chilling story that stuns your emotions. Frankenstein.
Don't touch that!
There it is, the 1931 thriller horror Frankenstein.
You can see why Mel Brooks took that and ran with it, can't you?
It's interesting that in the trailer for it, they say this is the movie you've heard about, talked about, but he never says this is the story you've read. And that's what your book does, is it really goes back to the beginning, right?
And that's right.
The novel. This was based on a novel, right?
It was based on a novel that was more than 100 years old at the time of the 1931 Karloff film. But the fact is that there were thousands of people who knew about Frankenstein but had never read the book. And probably by that point didn't even know there was a book. So
it had just become lore, just a regular story.
It had become lore, and that's one of the things that I thought was so fascinating as I started learning about this, is that the book Frankenstein, which we now consider a great work of English literature, but the book itself, which was published in 1818, almost instantly went out of print for probably, what was it? Let's see. It came back into print in 1831 in a quote-unquote standard novel edition. But during that period of time, those 13 years, it was pretty much out of print. And the fact is, still, even in those days, people were talking about it. There were playwrights making their own versions of it and putting it on the stage in London and Paris and New York. One of the members of Parliament used a reference to it in one of his debates on slavery. I mean, Frankenstein instantly was a myth, even if there wasn't a book for anyone to read.
We're talking with Susan Tyler Hitchcock. The phone lines are open. 977-1070 is the phone number. Her website is susantylerhitchcock.com, and the book is Frankenstein, A Cultural History. What led you to Mary Shelley? What led you to this story? I mean, you were probably like everybody else. You knew the story. You'd seen some of the many movies that had been made on this story.
It's funny, as I've talked to people about Frankenstein, many of them have really clear first memories of seeing the movie or reading the novel. I don't have one. But my fascination was with the Romantic poets, and I'd been studying them for a long time. And then I found myself teaching in the engineering school, teaching literature to engineering students, and what better book to use than Frankenstein?
Yeah.
So I was able to kind of pull my interest in the Romantic poets, and particularly Percy Bysshe Shelley, who was the husband of the author of Frankenstein, and bring my interest in the Romantic period to bear on teaching a novel about creating a human
Yeah.
And
1818 for the novel. It's interesting. And that, of course, is right there at the founding of the University of Virginia.
I've thought about that. I've wondered, you know, I haven't found any proof, but there is definitely a possibility that Jefferson would have read Frankenstein.
Wow.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, that really is. Yeah, absolutely.
I think he would have really liked the book, too. It's sort of out of the box kind of story that he could have
appreciated.
That.
So tell us, who was Mary Shelley?
I mean, so Mary Shelley, actually, when she came up with the idea of this book and started writing this book, wasn't even Mary Shelley. She was Mary Godwin. She was a young woman whose father was a very sort of famous political revolutionary. Has been by the time of Frankenstein, but still very influential. And her mother, Mary Wollstonecraft, is considered the first feminist writer of all history. She wrote a book called A Vindication of the Rights of Woman in the same period and in the same vernacular as Tom Paine's The Rights of Man. And
when was that?
That was 1792.
Holy cow.
Yes.
Gosh,
sad
way ahead of its time, wasn't it?
Mary Wollstonecraft died 10 days after giving birth to her daughter, Mary. And so from that point on, through her whole life, really, birth and death were linked in the experience of Mary Godwin Shelley.
Yeah.
She never knew her mother, and she also had tremendous difficulties giving birth and raising children. She gave birth, I think, 6 times, and she had one child who lived to adulthood. So for her, this whole idea of giving birth to death was very much a part of her experience and her imagination.
We're talking with Susan Tyler Hitchcock about her book, Frankenstein, A Cultural History. Was Mary Shelley, did she start writing as a kid, like most writers?
She wrote a little bit as a kid. She wrote a really funny poem. Her father, after Mary Wollstonecraft died, married a woman and started a children's publishing company. And actually, Tales from Shakespeare, the famous book of Shakespearean stories, was published by him, among other things. And he did publish one funny little poem by Mary Shelley Mary Godwin that I'm not even going to remember the name of. It made puns in French, but it was written in English. I mean, it was very precocious.
So this was a very educated, very smart woman.
Very educated, very smart, and very much born to literature and the world of the imagination and revolutionary thinking.
Yeah.
From both of her parents. She fell in love with this fellow named Percy Bysshe Shelley, who was also very literary, very intelligent, very revolutionary. And they ran away, leaving behind his wife, child, and another child to come. So when Mary Shelley came up with the idea of writing Frankenstein, she was a teenager on the run with a married man.
Much older?
Not too much older. 3 years older, I think. Not that much older.
Yeah.
These guys did it young.
But she already had this idea. It was cooking. Do we know where it came from?
It's hard to
what
say.
What inspired her?
Okay, so that the famous scene is the summer of 1816. It's Mary and Percy Bysshe Shelley. Byron, another totally outrageous poet of the day, and Mary's half-sister, Claire, who was in love with Byron. And the four of them got together and started telling ghost stories. And the story is, whether this is true or not, we don't know, but the story is that Byron said to them, "These ghost stories that we're reading from the French, they're nothing. We can do better than this. I challenge each of you to write a ghost story." And so they all went, every day or every night, whatever, to their desks trying to come up with it. Only two of them came up with stories. One was Mary Shelley, who ultimately came up with Frankenstein. The other was a fifth character in the mix, Byron's doctor, Polidori, who wrote ultimately a short story about a vampire that we believe in the long run inspired Bram Stoker in his writing of Dracula.
Wow.
So in an amazing way,
That's incredible.
Frankenstein and Dracula were born.
And the same conversation.
In the same conversation. Wow. Exactly.
We're talking with Susan Tyler Hitchcock. We're talking with Susan Tyler Hitchcock. Her website, of course, is susantylerhitchcock.com. And one of her many books is Frankenstein, A Cultural History. And we're looking at the life of Mary Shelley, the author. So the book comes out in 1818. Tell me now, first off, what's the reception to the book? And then we'll look at sort of compare the book to the story that most of us know out of the movies.
Yeah, all that we know about the reception of the book has to do with critics. And, that's not really true. The critics were very divided. There were some, and we think it probably was Sir Walter Scott, who thought that it was beautifully written. There were others, though, who were horrified by the morality of it. And, in fact, it's not the response to the novel so much as it is the response to stage renditions of the novel, which happened almost instantly.
Really?
In London, yeah. In those days, there weren't these copyright laws that would keep somebody from taking a story from a novel and turning it into a play. And so within 3 years, there were something like 15 different versions, some comic, some tragic, and some in between. The first and most famous, called Presumption, The Fate of Frankenstein. And it's really those that brought the story into the public imagination more than the novel itself. But even those had this, it was sort of there was a conservative reaction against it. I mean, this was a story that suggested that human beings might overstep the bounds that God placed upon us and, you know, try things that we were never supposed to do. And this was therefore immoral. And that was one of the prevailing responses to the novel. And for that matter, even to the 1931 movie, there were a lot of very negative responses to the morality and a lot of censorship that went on in those days
to the movie.
Yeah.
So the novel itself that comes out in 1818, is it the story of the monster who grunts and howls and goes out and threatens people and they grab their pitchforks? And
it's really a different story. It's a story about a creature made by a human, but abandoned instantly. A creature who had no name and therefore no identity, no family, no society, and who began sort of formless, but was made into a monster by the fact that he happened to be 8 feet tall. And he therefore, and he happened to be made of the parts of dead bodies, so he looked horrible. And because of his stature and his appearance, people responded with fear and violence, and that turned him into a monster. My reading of the moral of the book is there is a debate on this. My reading is that this really is saying, look out for what you do, if you're going to create, if you're going to push the limits of our knowledge of our science, take care of what you create.
Yeah.
Now, other people read the novel as a sort of warning, don't mess with Mother Nature, which is really the way it's been taken more commonly in the reinterpretations and the readaptations over and over.
But the novel doesn't condemn the maker. Does it? It just sort of warns the maker, don't abandon your creation.
The funny thing is that there are two versions of the novel. In 1818, it came out, and I don't think there is a single use of the word God in that, and there's not much judgmental reflection at all. Then, remember I mentioned that in 1813, it was republished as a standard novel. There was a lot of living that Mary Shelley did between 1818 and 1831, and she was a different woman. She was a single mother trying to make a living as a writer. She was also depending on the income from her then-dead husband's father and really had to sort of be a little less radical and more appropriate. And the whole layer of judgment and saying, oh, he made a wrong step here. If only he hadn't made that creature, nothing would have gone wrong. And, you know, all of that gets laid on top of the earlier version. So she sort of censors herself in the sense of adding judgment on what she had written. I think of the first one as almost like a dream. It's like, you know, dreams come out and you don't even think about what they mean. And then she had this dozen or so years to think about it and also worry about and watch society respond.
And then something different comes
up. And she corrected it.
We're talking with Susan Tyler Hitchcock about her book, Frankenstein, A Cultural History. We're talking with Susan Tyler Hitchcock about one of her many books, Frankenstein, A Cultural History. Susan, we were talking during the break about, Mary Shelley's first edition of Frankenstein, 1818, really comes out of the Industrial Revolution when people are moving off of the farms and into factories and making things in a different way than they were used to making things.
Yes, and using machinery to create power, to generate power, the steam engine. Actually, Percy Bysshe Shelley invested in a steam engine project, as a matter of fact. He was very interested in the steam engine. Everybody thinks of him as sort of like a little fairy that flitted around with these poems. But in fact, he was really interested in chemistry, science. And the other thing that was happening in those days is the harnessing of energy. I mean, Benjamin Franklin was one of them. There were Englishmen as well who were learning how to take the power of electricity that they knew in nature and use it, you know, put it into batteries, or for that matter, discover what it did or whether it was in the human body. And one of the most clear inspirations for this concept of a body brought back to life was the fact that there were experiments being done and even shows being put on with the corpses of criminals, in which the scientist would actually insert an electrical charge and make the body move, make it jump, make it sit up, make the eyes open, make the tongue roll. And we know that Byron and Shelley were talking about these things in those evenings of the summer of 1816. So those images and those ideas must have been kind of rolling around in Mary Shelley's head as she was beginning to come up with this novel.
Now, the movies, we take it, in our cultural understanding of the idea of Frankenstein, which has been, you know, morphed and evolved and moved away from the novel. But the idea that we inherit and we talk about when we say Frankenstein is really a story about technology gone awry. And,
yes,
definitely. Is that part of her story,
the
original
really
story?
The really interesting thing is that it's very hard to find much of any technology in the novel. The early version, the 1818 version, young Victor Frankenstein talks about learning about electricity and these sorts of machinery, this sort of machinery. But when we get right down to actually putting life in the creature, it's very vague. The word engine is used, but it's not the kind of, automobile motor kind of engine we're talking about. It has more to do with something, but she never even describes it. She never tells you exactly how it happens. But then when you take this book to visuals and turn it into movies, you got to make up those machines, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so when in 1931 comes around, that's one of the most spectacular parts of that movie in those days, was those amazing Van de Graaff generators and this sizzling, lights and the electricity coming up and down and all this sort of thing. And there's some pretty interesting stories about the guy who created all those machines. He was quite a character in his own right.
We're talking with Susan Tyler Hitchcock. She's online at susantylerhitchcock.com, talking about one of her books, Frankenstein, A Cultural History. So what is the monster in the novel actually called Frankenstein?
No, that's one of the interesting things. He has no name. And it's Mary Shelley's way of saying he has no identity, he has no core, he has no self, and that's the start of his misery. And true to form, when the play, the novel was turned into plays early on. And even in 1931, if you look at the credits, there's no name given.
Just
for
the
monster.
Yeah.
But almost instantly, the word Frankenstein was being used for the monster himself. In fact, in the novel and in you know, accurate renditions of it, Victor Frankenstein is the name of the scientist who makes the creature.
Yeah. Is it a commentary as well, the novel, you know, the man without a family, without a name, without a society, a commentary on maybe perhaps too much individualism, like don't remove yourself from society. There's danger there, you know, stick with the pack, stay with your culture.
There definitely has been a suggestion of that. And it's been, you know, it's been suggested that Victor Frankenstein is sort of a Percy Bysshe Shelley, that he's sort of a romantic hero who's casting aside all social rules and trying to live by his brain alone, by his mind and his imagination alone, and that Mary Shelley's suffering as the wife of this kind of guy is coming through in her novel about the big mistakes that that Victor Frankenstein is making.
So that, and that proved not to be a successful marriage she ran off with this guy.
No, it was a difficult marriage, and it was also a short-lived marriage because Percy Bysshe Shelley drowned in 1822.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. They had already run away once in 1814, and then in 1816 they ran away again. They went back to England, but they were still together, not married, but still together. 1816 they ran away again to England. They went back from England to Switzerland. They went back to England where soon thereafter, let's see, this would be 1817, his wife committed suicide, thus allowing them to marry. She left two children behind whom he never saw again, but they did marry right about the, right around the new year of 1818. And then soon thereafter, both Frankenstein was published and their first child was born.
In the same year?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Right.
Susan Tyler Hitchcock is my guest. The book is Frankenstein, A Cultural History. Let me ask you, why is it, you think, that this story has just become so much a part of our culture and Western culture, and I'm assuming it has its manifestations in the East as well. Really is a worldwide story.
It is a worldwide story. Some have said that it is the first modern myth. It is a myth of the possibility of a world without a God, and I think that's a really important reason that it keeps being told, because it scares us, and it, depending on how you take it, it can either tell us the rules that we need to follow, or it can scare and, for that matter, challenge us in a way to see more of the possibility of being human than a world with God might let us be.
Yeah.
So I think that's one really important reason. It sort of has no answer to it. There's a way in which it asks the question, should we or shouldn't we? Should we step over the line? Should we try to do more than anyone has ever done before? Should we take a chance and make something that no one's made before? Because it might go bad, but then it might be great. It asks all those questions, and my reading of the novel is that it doesn't really answer them. But we keep asking those questions of ourselves, you know, in everyday life and in the big questions of cloning and the nuclear bomb and, you know, the list goes on and on and on. All of the technology, you know, deep water drilling.
Right, right.
All of the technologies, they're all pushing the limit of what we as human beings are doing to our world. And they all carry huge risks. And the question of whether it's worth it or not is really sort of at the core of this novel and this myth that keeps being told over and over and over. It's almost like we practice the question as we think about the story.
It makes me think of the 20th century Japanese myth of post-war myth of Godzilla, this idea that some nuclear accident or something causes this monster to come from the sea.
Well, you know what? There's a movie, Frankenstein Meets Godzilla. It is a Japanese.
How poetic, isn't it?
It's a Japanese movie, and the story is that the the heart of the monster, got taken from Germany to Japan during World War II and was in Hiroshima at the time of the bomb. And the radiation turned it into a boy who keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and ultimately goes up Mount Fuji and meets Godzilla.
And who wins?
The boy does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Godzilla's always destroyed, right?
That's right.
Susan Tyler Hitchcock is my guest live in studio, and the phone lines are open at 977-1070. Let me ask you this just quick question. Did the novel include that scene that we all remember from the movie, the 1931 movie, of Frankenstein with the little girl and pulling the pebbles, the petals off of the flower?
Let me think. No.
So that was original to the movie. Yeah.
That is original to the movie, and that was one of the parts that got censored out, actually.
Because the censors thought it was just too much.
It was too much, exactly. There is an analogous scene, though, in the book that ends up being central to the film The Bride of Frankenstein, which came out in 1935, and to my mind is actually in some ways a better movie. It's more crafted. But the monster runs away from his creator almost upon birth. And then spends months kind of teaching himself. And the way that he learns a lot is he hangs out outside of a hut where there's a family. And he learns language. He learns to read. He actually ends up reading Paradise Lost to himself. And his interactions with that family, which includes an old blind man who comes to love him because he can't see him, and therefore he just hears this kindness in him and doesn't see how horrible he looks. That whole theme, I think, is being replayed, repurposed in the...
Because there's an old blind man in the movie, too, right?
That's in Bride of Frankenstein.
It is, okay. Yes. Alrighty. It's also a commentary on the idea of the other among us and difference.
Yes, totally.
And, yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely so, and how we react to the other with such horror and anger and repulsion, really. Yeah, definitely.
Because it's just so different from what we're used to.
Yep, yeah. Right.
Susan Tyler Hitchcock is live in studio. So what's the next book? What are you working on?
Well, you know, right now I'm working more as a book editor than a book writer. I have an idea.
Which still involves a lot of writing and a lot of creation.
Creativity. I work at National Geographic, and I help help create books from blank page up, and I love it. Sometimes a manuscript comes in, but a lot of times we decide we need to do a book on this, and I work with a team of people to create a book.
So, oh, that's great. That's fantastic. Any projects you want to promote or anything in the pipeline?
I'm very excited about it. See, the problem is the books that I'm now working on won't be out for another year.
Yeah.
I had the pleasure of working with Donovan Webster, who's
a
local.
Yeah.
He's done a book that came out last spring called Meeting the Family, in which he did his genetic reading and then went back all the way to the Rift Valley of Tanzania and met his human ancestors. That was really great.
That's great, isn't it?
And he and I are going to work on a book coming up now on moonshine, so look for that one.
Good stuff. Susan Tyler Hitchcock. Check her out online at susantylerhitchcock.com.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit cvillepodcast.com for more.